When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This 80s flick is a shining example of teenage adventures and unexpected chaos. This lively comedy about growing up invites us to revisit the wild night that forever changed the lives of a suburban babysitter and her diverse group of charges. The clever dialogue, surprising plot twists, and memorable characters make it a timeless favorite for those who grew up in the 80s. It reminds us that sometimes the most unforgettable nights are the unplanned ones, where the ordinary transforms into the extraordinary and friendships are forged in the midst of unexpected adventures. So jump into the station wagon, grab your plastic Thor hammer, and get ready to sing the blues as Bethany Wells and I discuss Adventures in Babysitting from 1987 on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast.
Meet Chris Parker, getting ready for the greatest night of her life.
Hi.
I gotta cancel.
Now she's stuck babysitting the Anderson kids. Sarah.
Mom got Chris to babysit for me.
Chris?
Her brother Brad and his best friend Gavin.
Who is this kid?
Stray dog.
Take good care of my baby. I'll guard her with my life.
What could possibly go wrong?
Chris, I'm in trouble. Hang up and sit down. I'll be there in half an hour. Well, I'm just
out of school. This is the night when things go from bad...
My mom's car!
...to worse.
Big city. Scum sucker.
Hey, I like danger.
You should try babysitting.
I'm still in control here.
You could say they were having a bad night.
Any problems?
No, not really.
If they weren't having such a good time. Adventures in Babysitting.
You think your parents will ever ask me to babysit again?
If they do, I'd ask them for a buck more an hour.
I'm Tim Williams, the mastermind behind the mic at the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. Joining me on each epic episode is a guest co-host who's as crazy about 80s flicks as they are about wearing parachute pants and solving Rubik's Cubes. We're diving into nostalgic treasures we saw at the local theater, rented on VHS tapes, or discovered on cable TV. From blockbusters that make you say,
I feel the need for speed.
To hidden gems that'll have you screaming,
they're here.
It's a blast to relive these old memories and share our thoughts on what made these movies so special. We reminisce about our first time watch experiences, share our favorite scenes, and even discover fascinating behind the scenes tales about the cast and crew along the way. Haven't hit that subscribe button yet? What are you waiting for?
Come on, do it.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. And hey, while you're at it, be a pal and drop us a written review along with a 5-star rating to tell us what you think about us.
The sportos and motorheads, geeks, sluts, bloods, wastoids, dweebies, they all adore him. They think he's a righteous dude.
Take a day off and come hang out with us on social media. Just search 80s Flick Flashback on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And don't forget to bookmark 80sflickflashback.com for more gnarly content.
Get out of town. I didn't know you did anything creative.
Want to crank it all the way up to 11? Become a supporter on buymeacoffee.com for only $5 a month.
Do or do not. There is no try.
Click the link in our episode show notes, and while you're there, soak up the extra trivia and fun stuff that didn't make it into today's show. Thanks again for tuning in. Now, let's get right into today's episode.
Welcome to the party, pal!
All right, welcome in, everybody. So glad to have you on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. We have finished the scary, spooky season, and now into
Christmas!
Yes, sort of. There is snow in this one, but I think it actually takes place in March, not in November. But, you know, yeah, it still gives that cool, you know, a fall or winter vibe.
Absolutely. It's cozy.
Exactly.
It makes you never want to leave the house, sure. In my opinion. It does. I'm a boring person, so it makes me go like, that sounds terrible, actually. I'm just going to stay home.
Right. It does make me not want to drive into the city anytime soon.
Ever. I remember being a kid just thinking like, oh my gosh, the minute I get on the interstate going into the city, I'm going to get a flat tire and my whole life will be ruined.
Yeah. Just always try to convince your best friend not to go to the bus station. I think that's rule number one.
Just don't run away from home.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Well, of course, we're talking about Adventures in Babysitting from 1987, and hopefully you've already caught the awesome interview that I had with Keith Coogan, who was a part of this movie, and one of the reasons why we know who he is, because it was one of his first really big movies. So go back and listen to that as well. Glad to have back. It's been a long time, too long probably.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
Lovely to have Miss Bethany Wells back with us to talk about this 80s classic, which she's not really old enough to know about it being from the 80s because she saw it probably much later, right?
I saw it. I didn't see it in the 80s, but it was something I watched as a child.
Okay. Yeah.
In the early 90s. So yeah. I think one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Late 87. So probably hit video in 88 and cable in 89. So it probably had a little bit of the longevity. And I'm sure being a Touchtone Pictures.
It was
with Disney. They probably played it on the Disney Channel some too, I think.
I don't remember. I think my parents would often get like the free HBO weekend.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm pretty sure this one was part of that rotation and it got recorded on a VHS.
Oh, so you just watched
it over again. And so then I just owned it, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Because when we recorded, you own it. That was, you know, that's how we lived in the 80s.
This podcast has made me, this podcast has really made me realize like how many movies my family owned just because we had the occasional free HBO weekend and a VCR with a recorder.
Right, right. Yeah, so I dated a girl after high school, between high school and college, and her dad, like she said, he had like all the movie channels and he had his VCR like set to record movies during the day, like he wanted every movie that would come on. He had like this huge VHS collection. And I'm like, that amazing. Sounds cool. But then like, when do you actually sit down and watch the movies you recorded? Do you have time to watch the movies that you recorded? But
you find the time.
Right, right. But as a teenager at that time, I was like, that was so cool. It's like, oh man, you know, I mean, I was recording movies, but a lot of the movies that I'd recorded off of TV. Like by the time it came to cable, I think it was just because they played it so much on cable, I didn't think about recording it because it's going to be on again at some point, and you know, I'll just catch it when I catch it. But yeah, so I saw Adventures in Babysitting in the theater. I remember going to the movies to see it. I don't think I saw it like when it first came out. I think it had been out for a while and caught it then. But of course, I was a big fan of Elizabeth Shue because she was in Karate
Who
Kid.
Who wasn't? Oh right. My goodness, she's so iconic. Oh, love her.
Yeah, so this being like her first, you know, lead in a movie, it was a big deal. And then, you know, of course, I got to know the other characters and enjoyed them as well. I definitely remember seeing this in the theater and just loving it so much. And then it was probably, 87. So probably like 4 or 5 years later when I was on VHS, I think I saw it like a VHS at Walmart for like $10 or like something like super cheap. And I was like, oh my gosh, you mean I can own this on a VHS?
Oh,
yeah. So I remember buying it and like going over to a friend's house that had not seen it. I was like, how have you not seen this movie? And like sat down and watched it. And it was like reliving it all over again. And I had that for a long time. So now I have the Blu-ray, but yeah, it's just a fun movie.
Yeah. I had actually, when I was preparing for this podcast, I was starting to watch it on Disney Plus.
Mm-hmm.
And as I don't know if you watched it on Disney Plus, but there's like a little placard at the beginning that says like, this has been edited for content. And I was like, that's odd.
Yeah.
And I really didn't notice it until about halfway through. And I was like, oh, they're editing the language.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so we have it on Blu-ray, and I ended up just like putting the Blu-ray in so I could get the unedited version.
Yeah. Yeah. So probably a couple of months ago, I wanted to watch it again. Well, I was planning, you know, like I said in the interview episode with Keith Coogan, we were supposed to record like several months ago.
Yes,
so I had rewatched a couple of the movies getting ready for that. And then he had to push it back. So I have the Blu-ray. So I watched the Blu-ray then. And I was like, you know, I remembered everything, all the lines, whatever. But today we rewatched and Hannah was with me. So I was like, oh, I'll just put on the Disney Plus version. And of course it's all a thing. And I was like, I knew they were going to adjust the F word in the middle. Cause I'd seen that like when it first hit Disney Plus, it was all over social media about why did they change it? But then as I was doing some research,
there were a couple of tweaks.
Yeah. They said they basically put the TV version, which I was like, as it was going on, I was like, oh yes, I used to have this version on a VHS, like before I owned the original. I had obviously recorded the TV version because I remember I knew all the alternate words that they had used in those scenes. So,
but it was the moment that hit me was when Daryl was like, you've got to be kidding me.
Right.
Like, watch your language. And I was like, what?
He didn't really say anything. Yeah.
He hasn't said anything.
There's another line that they took out too, where right before they leave, and she was like, I will murder you, come into your house and murder you. And then he says,
and
you know,
raped.
And they totally cut that out. And she's like,
I don't blame them. It's so cringy.
Yeah. There's
so
a few
much
things
of his character is cringy. Yeah.
There's a few things I'm glad they changed the line about Thor in the Disney Plus version.
I agree.
So that was I was like, ooh, that's a little easier to swallow. That watching it on the Blu-ray, I was like, oh man, I hate that was such a common insult back then.
I agree.
So you know, as most 80s movies, they don't age that well, you know. So
what? Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. No, I agree. I didn't hate any of the edits that I noticed.
Yeah. Yeah.
It didn't change any of the movie really. It just made it. The only scene that really didn't make sense was him saying, "You've got to be kidding me."
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm just like, okay, we've got other movies in here that do use that word.
Right.
Let's say it.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was funny too, because I'm like, you know, I have the, you know, there's a lot of stuff they've added to Disney Plus that has, you know, TVMA or whatever. So I was like, you know, why would they not just put the PG-13 version?
Yeah.
But it's more of what you consider a family movie. So they're trying to keep it more on the family friendly side. But anyway,
yeah,
enough about Disney Plus. They're not a sponsor yet. Please call me.
Yeah, anyway. We're open to it.
Right. Love to sing your praises every chance I get. How long had it been since you watched it before you're watching it for the podcast?
It had probably been a couple of years. It's one of those that I forget how much I just genuinely adore this movie until I start to think about it. I'm like, oh, I want to watch that movie again. It's so good. And so it had been a while. It's not one that I had like introduced to the girls yet. If we watch it with them, it'll probably be the Disney Plus version.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it is so much fun. Like I said, I watched it a ton as a kid, but it had been a few years since I'd watched it. And I remember in high school, I'm a huge fan of the musical Rent. And Anthony Rapp had come out with like an autobiography. Mm-hmm. And I read his book and he mentioned that he had been in that movie. And I was like, that was him? And it had been so long. So I remembered watching it after I read his book. But yeah, it's so good.
Yeah. Disney Channel did a remake like 7 years ago, something like that. It's been a while.
Yeah.
And so when I saw, I was like, oh, they're going to remake it. I'm like, oh, this should be fun to see. And it's a totally different story. There's really nothing that's the same besides the two girls are friends, but all the adventures are completely different. And so right after we watched it with my daughter, I was like, man, I want to go back and watch the original. And so I found it on one of the streaming sites at that point and rewatched it. And, really enjoyed it. But I think even then when Daryl popped up, I was like, that guy looks so familiar. Like, I know he's been in stuff since this, but I was like, I can't place his name. So then when I pulled him up on IMDb, I was like, oh, that makes sense.
That
guy. Oh, that's why I've seen him so many times. It's like, oh yeah. So yeah, it was kind of cool to see that was his first big role.
Yeah. And then for anybody who's not a huge musical fan, he's also in the new Star Trek show that's streaming now. So yeah, pretty great. Love Anthony Rapp.
Yeah, we'll touch on some of that when we get into casting. So let's jump into story origin and pre-production. So a lot of this that I got, and it'll be in the show notes, I pulled from an article that was from, I think, a convention where David Simkins, the screenwriter, Keith Coogan, and somebody else were there like answering questions. And so these are like firsthand accounts. So I think this is pretty much more accurate than my regular Wikipedia research that I do.
Right.
So David Simkins, the screenwriter, originally wrote the story as a spec script while working as a development executive at Roger Corman's old company, New World Pictures. Although they passed on his idea, Simkins believed that someone could eventually want to buy the story. The script was passed from a friend to a friend to another friend until it reached Linda Obst and Deborah Hill. You may recognize Deborah Hill's name because she was the wife of John Carpenter, or the partner with John Carpenter who made Halloween. So if you know that name, that's where that comes in. So not too far off from horror movies as we start in November. But anyway, Simpkins said he wrote it quickly and knew the script didn't need to be perfect. It just needed to have a good, solid idea. The first draft was pretty much what you see in the movie, but as it was being shopped, it got turned into a complicated Ocean's 11 heist film. But Linda and Deborah realized that it was way too expensive to do it that way, so they suggested turning it back into just a series of adventures, which I think was much smarter. The role of the babysitter, Chris, was originally proposed to Molly Ringwald, and Paramount either purchased the movie or optioned the script. The project was in development for about a year, and because Ferris Bueller was such a big hit, it served as a major inspiration for them wanting to make the movie. But Paramount, of course, had Molly Ringwald as one of their stars on contract, so they had her in mind for the role, but she passed on it because she didn't want to keep playing teenage roles. I'm very thankful
for that. That's understandable. Yeah, that's so understandable. Yeah. I love Molly Ringwald. You know, you can't like 80s movies without, you know, loving her.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But I don't know if Chris would have been, she obviously would have been different. I don't know if I would have loved her as much as I do, considering she was played by Elizabeth Shue.
Oh, yeah. Oh, get ready. There's some other actresses that are going to
that
went out for it.
Yes.
So when Molly Ringwald passed on it, that left Paramount with a dilemma. They had to figure out who among their roster of stars they could put in the babysitter role. For a week, they seriously considered Bette Midler, who would have required a significant rewrite, but that didn't work out.
Yeah. Okay.
Obviously, took it out of being a teenager, that's for sure. Then they turned to Cher.
Okay.
Yeah, then they turned to Cher, which put the movie in turnaround until Deborah, Linda, and Chris Columbus, who directed it, took it and pitched it to Disney. Jeffrey Katzenberger approved the project and was greenlit immediately. So, yeah, I guess they were fear they didn't have any teenagers. So then they were thinking, well, maybe if the babysitter's an adult, they just change it up. But, yeah that's too
interesting.
Weird.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying they would have done a bad job because it's Bette Midler and Cher.
Right, right.
So they don't, you know, they usually turn out some pretty quality work.
Right.
But it would have been different.
And they were probably thinking, too, they need a bankable star. They were thinking, you know, Elizabeth Shue, of course, she was, you know, we knew who she was, but she'd never been the lead of a movie before.
Right.
So I'm sure they were thinking, hey, we need a big name to carry this movie for it to make any money if they weren't as sold on the script, since it had been tossed around so many times. It wasn't like the hottest script out there that they knew they could make a lot of money off of.
And now these messages.
Are you a fan of movies and TV shows inspired by comics? Ready for a podcast that dives deep into the thrilling world of adaptations? Well, look no further. Welcome to Moving Panels, the podcast where we discuss movies and TV shows based on, inspired by, and adapted from the world of comic books. This is your go-to podcast for all things comics on screen. I'm your host, Laramie Wells, and every Monday we explore the dynamic universe where ink meets action. We break down the classics, reveal hidden gems, and uncover the creative process behind your favorite adaptations. Subscribe to Moving Panels now on your favorite podcast platform and join us on this epic journey through the pages of comics and onto the big screen. Remember, new episodes drop every Monday. Don't miss out. Moving Panels, where every panel has a story and every adaptation is a blockbuster. Subscribe today, and I'll see you on the other side of the page.
Hey there, fellow 80s movie aficionados. Are you ready to embark on a nostalgia-filled journey to the greatest era of cinema? Then look no further than the Retro Life for You 80s Movie Podcast. Join us every week as we rewind the VHS tapes, dust off those Betamax classics, and dive headfirst into the neon-soaked, totally tubular world of the 1980s movies. From the Brat Pack to action heroes, we've got it all covered. Breakfast Club, Ghostbusters, E.T. and Indiana Jones, and more. It's like a trip in Doc Brown's time machine, but without the DeLorean. So whether you're a diehard 80s film buff or just curious about the cinematic gems of the past, Retro Life for You is your ticket to the ultimate movie time warp. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Retro Life for You. And we can be found anywhere you listen to your podcast, as well as on our website, www.retrolife4u.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It's kind of talking about casting. Over 150 actresses auditioned for the lead role of Chris in Dallas, Florida, New York, Toronto, Chicago, and LA. All right, this is a very fun list. So Julia Louis-Dreyfus auditioned for the role, but withdrew because they were looking at getting Jodie Foster. Jodie Foster also withdrew, leaving Michelle Pfeiffer, Valerie Bertinelli, Elizabeth Shue, and Justine Bateman as the last choices. Bateman withdrew from the project due to creative conflicts, quote unquote.
What does that mean?
Who knows? whenever they put that, it's like, you know, either she had ideas that the producers didn't like, or the producers had ideas that she didn't like and didn't want to budge on, or
she just had ideas and they didn't like.
Right. And then Pfeiffer left the project to star in Witches of Eastwick instead, which that was a big hit for her. So,
oh yeah.
And then Valerie Bertinelli lost out to Elizabeth Shue on the final day of auditions. But Keith Coogan did say that he remembers doing screen tests with a number of actresses who went out for the part, including Phoebe Cates. But he added nobody quite captured the essence of the character like Elizabeth Shue, who was a student at Harvard University at the time.
Not to jump the gun, that opening scene where she is doing the lip sync says so much about her character and sells that character to the audience so much. Mm-hmm. It establishes, you know, her age, her maturity, but also just like her sense of fun and her sense of adventure. And it just endears you to her so fast. I'm not saying no other actor could have done it, but nobody could have done it quite the way she did it.
That's good seeing it. Even when she first comes to the house and she's interacting with Brad, when, you know, he gets embarrassed, you know, that could have been played a lot of different ways. And he was like,
she could have been so cruel about it.
Yeah. But she's like, Yeah, she's like, he's like, I love your hair, I love your eyes. She's like, what do you like about it? She's like, let me teach you how to talk to, you know, a girl that you like. Obviously she knows humans. At that point. Yeah. And of course he got embarrassed, but I was like, that once again shows, even though she's a teenager, she's definitely mature enough to, you know how to handle herself and be respectful. Mm-hmm. And this is not one of those movies I would think about, who would you recast in this role? Like, this one's pretty perfect in the casting as far as I'm concerned. There's nobody in this
pretty much across the board.
Yeah, yeah. Like some of the heavies, but even then, like, they're not so fundamental to the story that you need them to be a different actor. No. But they all play their role really well. All right, well, let's talk about the lovely Elizabeth Shue, or as Keith kept calling her, Lisa, which I'm sure that was the name she he was like, yeah, Lisa for this. I was like, who's Lisa? I was like, oh, Elizabeth, Lisa. Lisa. Who's Lisa? I was like, okay.
Yeah, no, I'm cool. I can be friends with Lisa right. Shue.
Yeah, yeah. Can I call her Lisa when I meet her? He was like, yeah. Pete said I could call you Lisa. Is that okay? Anyway. So she started her acting career during her studies at Columbia High School, and after her parents' divorce, she appeared in several television commercials, including Burger King, where she acted alongside future stars Sarah Michelle Gellar and Leah Thompson. She also appeared in commercials for De Beers Diamonds, Chewels Bubblegum, and Hellman's Mayonnaise. She had minor roles in The Royal Romance of Charles and Diana in 1982 and Somewhere Tomorrow in 1983, where she starred alongside Sarah Jessica Parker. Of course, she made her feature film debut in 1984 when she co-starred with Ralph Macchio in The Karate Kid. She was a series regular as the teenage daughter of a military family in the short-lived TV series Call to Glory between 84 and 85, which she followed in 1986, starring alongside Terrence Stamp in the British horror film Link, which Keith mentions in the interview. In 87, she appeared in the television movie Double Switch, part of the Disney Sunday movie series, co-starring with George Newbern, who would go on to support her in her first star vehicle, Adventures of Babysitting, the same year. So they were in both of those movies the same year, which that was cool. Of course, in 88, she starred in Cocktail as a love interest of Tom Cruise. The following year, she starred in the short film Body Wars, and which was used at Epcot in the Atlas Simulator attraction in the Wonders of Life Pavilion until 2007. Other roles followed, including appearing as Jennifer Parker, as we discussed in our Back to the Future panels for parts 2 and 3, where she replaced Claudia Wells, who declined the role to reprise her role because of her family illness. Of course, we've discussed that in depth. So go back and listen to the Back to the Future episodes, and you can go back and listen to the Karate Kid episodes because we do a little deep dive into Elizabeth Shue there as well. But yeah, as we said, perfect for the role. I think she embodies that character perfectly. And I can't see anybody else in that role.
She does such a good job of being, she's very intelligent. She makes horrible mistakes throughout the entire movie. Like pretty much everything could have been avoided if she had just like had a brain for a little bit. Like honestly, obviously Brenda running away, she couldn't have controlled that.
Right.
But there are so many times where she just makes the wrong decision.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's so nice to see a female character being completely flawed. Like, she is not mm-hmm. this manic pixie dream girl.
Oh, right. Perfect. Right.
She makes mistakes, and yet she just keeps pushing forward. She is mm-hmm. strong. She's intelligent. And you trust her, even though you really shouldn't, just because of all the terrible decisions she makes.
Yeah.
But she's so endearing. It's just, I love her character.
Yeah. As you say, she makes a lot of, like, you know, leaving your purse at the house. That's a big, which it was funny because watching it today, I kind of paid attention because I was like, where is her purse when she leaves? Like, where is it? And it's still like on the couch because it was where Sarah grabs the book about going to college or whatever. But then when she goes outside, I noticed, I was like, well, wouldn't you get your keys in your purse? But her keys were in the coat pocket. Like, she's grabbing the keys out of the coat pocket, going to the car. So, like, oh, really, I can see you have your keys. And, of course, back then we didn't carry our cell phones. So we weren't thinking about, oh, where's my phone or where's my wallet? She was just, you know, and someone kind of panic. My friend's in trouble. Let me go get them. So it does somewhat make sense that she forgot it.
I do have a question, though, because this whole thing could have been avoided. As soon as she gets the flat tire. She's like, we'll wave somebody down. I'll buy a tire. I have my checkbook.
Right.
Okay. But just earlier, when Brenda called you, she was like, hey, can you please pay for the cab when I get there? And she's like, that's going to be $40. I don't have $40.
Yeah.
I mean, you have enough on your checkbook to buy a tire.
Right.
But not, can you, could you not use a checkbook to pay for a cab?
I don't think so. I think, yeah, I don't think that was something that cabbies took checks. Like, it wasn't a, you know, a business where they could verify funds and things of that nature. So, yeah. But that's a good, like, that is a good point though. Yeah.
I mean, she had an hour. She could have called her mom and just been like, my dumb friend, Brenda, mom,
I
need $40. I'll write you a check.
Or just, I need 40, you know, oh, the parents forgot to leave money for the kids. Can I borrow $40 until they get back and pay? Yeah. Yeah. She's, there's always those extra things. Yeah, exactly.
But again, it would have been no movie. It would have been a super boring movie if she had just used a little bit of logic.
Mm-hmm.
But again, she's 18, so she's not thinking straight.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just love that. It was a very relatable line. Mm-hmm. That's going to be $40. I don't have $40. Brenda.
But just think about it. Let's just think about the financials here. $50 for a tire or $40 for a cab ride. I'm like, first of all, I'd love to get a tire for $50 now. That would be awesome. I could get four tires like tomorrow and be very happy.
Yeah.
Inflation is not the same. Yeah. And even like when, you know, they shoot out the windshield, like that ended up being like what, 25? Well, I don't remember if he said how much it was, but he was like,
I don't know, but he covered it.
Yeah.
He should have. Honestly, he should have paid for all of it.
He should have, yeah.
He shot at them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so fun. Yeah, this movie is so crazy. I mean, it's but that's what makes it fun. Like, it was an adventure because it was perfectly titled "Adventures in Babysitting," which I think in the UK it was released as "A Night on the Town" or something like that.
That's
like,
boring.
It's like, I don't think that grabs the same, you know, sense of what the movie was about. As watching it again today, you realize how much of a fantasy, quote unquote, it is, because there's so many different things that are like, it is kind of like that typical family movie where, you know, it's bad, but it's not real bad, or like, you know,
it's dangerous, but not really.
Yeah. It's good to have a car thief with a heart of gold that's going to save you from the really bad guys. And then, you know, it's easy to, like, you know, accidentally come out on stage in a blues bar and be able to sing on stage.
And that's how you get away.
You dance off the stage to get out. Yeah.
And do you know once I got older, like when I was a kid, I was like, well, one day I'm going to bust up in a blues bar and they're going to tell me nobody leaves here without singing the blues. I'm sure there are plenty of people that leave there without singing the blues.
I thought that was, and we're going to get to that scene as we get going, because there's some fun stuff there. But yeah, as a kid, I was like, oh, well, that's, you know, if I ever get in trouble downtown, I just don't have as long as I've got a blues song in my pocket, I should be okay.
You know? and it's so hard.
Right.
It's okay.
But yeah, and then at the end when Sarah's like hanging from the window and, like, you know, she's outside the party.
She would be dead.
Right. She's at the window. Like, everybody in the party is obviously not looking out the window and does not see this child. Like, nobody notices.
One person in that party glances towards the window.
Right.
Towards the beautiful Chicago skyline to see a child.
Yeah, but they'd all been drinking, so they probably would have thought it was their imagination anyway. It's like,
they would have had to be doing something besides just drinking to think probably, it was in their imagination. Probably. Which, it was the 80s, so maybe.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah, yeah. Company parties.
Oh yeah.
All right, so let's get back to the cast. We're jumping all over the place like we like to do, but anyway, so it's okay. No, you're good. All right, so Keith Coogan as Brad Anderson. Of course, I got a chance to talk to Keith. So that was great. I'm going to mention that probably one of the 15 times.
Such a really cool interview.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely. So,
I'm introduced myself now. Hi, I'm Tim Williams. I interviewed Keith Coogan for my podcast. Anyway.
Yeah.
But as a child, he appeared on episodes of Little House on the Prairie, The Waltons, The Love Boat, Fantasy Island, The Vernon Shirley, Mork and Mindy, Eight is Enough, Knight Rider, Growing Pains, Silver Spoons, Fame and Chips, or all the shows from my childhood. It's like every show I watched as a child.
I love that it seems like any, like, actor that was really famous during that time had guest spots on all the shows you just mentioned.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure.
Anytime you hear somebody, oh, yeah, they were on The Love Boat and they were on Mork and Mindy and Laverne and Shirley. Knight Rider. All of them.
Knight Rider. Yeah. Growing Pains. Silver Spoons. Yeah.
Yeah. Growing Pains for sure.
Which he said that he auditioned for the Mike Seaver role on Growing Pains. Oh, so I thought that was
bless his heart.
Yeah. Didn't get there. But anyway, so he also starred in films including Cousins, Hiding Out, Cheetah, Toy Soldiers, Book of Love, Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, as well as straight-to-video releases such as Python, Soul Keeper, and Downhill Willie. So a few of those you can catch on Tubi. So
for sure. I've already told you a couple of movies where if you ever move on to the 90s, I've already gotten dibs. There's, you know, Birdcage. And there's also Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. Because yeah, that's in that same vein as Adventures in Babysitting for me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's done some stuff where he's like, he's the king of the babysitter movies because he did two babysitter movies that are he's most popular for. But definitely, if you haven't seen Hiding Out, go watch that one. It's great with John Cryer. And then Toy Soldiers is another big favorite of mine. Also a 90s movie released in 1990, you know, so, you know. But right. If I ever move to 90s, that's definitely going to be on my list. Another fun one. So,
yeah.
All right. And then we'll talk about Anthony Rapp. We mentioned him earlier as Daryl Cooper Smith. I don't know why he needed Cooper Smith. And
his mother was very progressive and somehow had the least progressive child ever.
Right. Right. But I love how when Brad's introducing everybody at the chop shop, he's like, and this is my best friend, Daryl Cooper Smith. Like, he's got to give his full name.
Love it so much.
Daryl Bradley Cooper Smith, whatever his middle name is.
He looks like a Daryl Bradley Cooper Smith.
He does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So as we mentioned, Rapp first performed on Broadway in 1981 in The Little Prince and the Aviator, a musical based on the novel The Little Prince. It closed during previews. He made his big screen debut right here on Adventures in Babysitting, directed by Chris Columbus, who later directed Rapp in the film version of Rent several years later. Rapp has appeared in several movies and Broadway shows. His notable roles include those in such films as Dazed and Confused, A Beautiful Mind, School Ties, Road Trip, 6 Degrees of Separation. He was in the stage and film version, as well as Rent. Fun fact, he dyed his naturally blonde hair red for the movie. The producers were concerned his blonde hair would mind audiences too much of Anthony Michael Hall.
To be fair, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, I read that, I was like, That's pretty accurate. I would definitely see that.
He looked very much like Anthony Michael Hall.
And he did kind of play that character a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, that was a good call. And to be honest, it wasn't until I read that little tidbit while we were getting ready for this that I was like, oh, he's naturally blonde. In my head, he's a redhead. Even though most of the stuff, I guess, he has been blonde. In my head, he's a redhead.
That was the first time you saw him. So I'm sure you're probably like first time association. Yeah.
Well, I guess so. But like the first time I really paid attention to it being Anthony Rapp was Rent. Mm-hmm. And I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know.
I'd have to go back and watch all those to remember. All right, so moving right along, we got Maya Bruton as Sarah Anderson. I thought this was funny. I didn't realize. In 1985, she appeared in Back to the Future as Sally Baines, the younger sister of Marty McFly's mother, Lorraine Baines. So she's only in that dinner where they're sitting around the dinner table scene. I have to go back and watch and see her there. After her role in Adventures in Babysitting, she played one of the children in the 1990 TV movie with Robert Mitchum, which was the basis for the series A Family for Joe, and co-starred the 1990 TV movie Sky Trackers with Pamela Sue Martin. This was followed by her run on Parker Lewis Can't Lose, which was a show that I definitely watched and probably remembered her in that as well. Her other television credits during the late 80s included appearances on 21 Jump Street, Highway to Heaven, Trapper John MD, and The Wonder Years.
Very cool. I probably saw her in The Wonder Years because I loved that show.
Yep.
But other than that, you know, Back to the Future and Adventures in Babysitting. She does such a good job in this movie.
Yeah.
She's the perfect, like, kid at that age. A lot of babies, when a kid is that age, they have the tendency to make them wise beyond their years.
Right. Or overly annoying to the, like, yeah. So immature, they're annoying. Kind of.
And she is just that. Yeah, she's annoying in the same mm-hmm. way that any little sister is annoying.
Right.
But she does such a good job of, you know, she's just hyper fixated on Thor and she's got all of these facts. And I love mm-hmm. that also she's played by a female character. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a female character who's obsessed with this superhero. Mm-hmm. And she's got all these facts. Because a lot of times a character like that would be given to a boy.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I, she's just, she's so funny. And she's, it's so clever at the beginning when she's mad at her brother for calling mm-hmm. Thor, depending on the version that you watched, but calling right. Thor a weirdo.
Mm-hmm.
And she tricks him into admitting that he likes Chris in front yeah. of her without him knowing. It's so
he's funny. Writing her love poems.
Yeah, so good. She's just the perfect mm-hmm. kid in a yes. movie, which you don't see very often.
Oh, yeah. Like you said, in the 80s, they were typically like, or even someone now, like the kids are smarter than the adults. They're the wiser yeah. ones, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it was good to see her be like a true
kid.
Like, 10, 11 yeah, year 10 old. And
10, 8, 9-ish, like somewhere yeah, in that range. Like she's still very much a child.
Mm-hmm.
You don't forget that she's a child and she makes bad decisions when she's mm-hmm. not being watched because yeah. she's 10.
Right. Right.
Like, and she gets bored and she wanders off even though they're being chased by gangsters
mm-hmm.
because there's a toy store.
Right. And Hannah kept saying when the car gets the flat tire, this is great. Like, she's like, this is great. And it's like, why does she think this is great? Like, because it's something new and exciting. Right. Right. She doesn't know what's dangerous.
Yeah.
She's a kid.
She doesn't realize that they could die.
Right. Yeah. That's the farthest thing from her mind.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a little cool tidbit from the movie. She wears a backpack with a picture of Gizmo on it. And this is, of course, a reference to Gremlins, which was written by Chris Columbus, the director.
Hey, very clever.
Yep. All right, moving right along. We got Penelope Ann Miller as Brenda, which this is another great character. And she's so funny.
It's like, so good. I do think when I was younger, I thought both she and Elizabeth Shue were a lot older than just 17.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's probably because they were played by actors that were a lot older than 17. But yeah. Brenda specifically, I thought was at least 30 when I was a kid.
I didn't think she was that much older, but they did. I will say this. Brenda definitely is less mature. Like, you can tell mm-hmm. she's a little bit less mature. But yeah, she does. They definitely look older than 17 that they're supposed yeah. to be. I mean, I was like, surely in college, like, you know, 19, 20.
Yeah.
Which I think we'll get to it. I think Elizabeth Shue was 23 when they yeah. filmed this. So, yeah. But Penelope Ann Miller, she began her career on Broadway in the 1985 original production of Biloxi Blues and received a Tony Award nomination for the 89 revival of Our Town. She's appeared in several major Hollywood films, particularly in the late 80s and early 90s, including the film version of Biloxi Blues in 88 with Matthew Broderick. Of course, Big Top Pee Wee with Pee Wee Herman in 88, The Freshman in 1990, Awakenings in 90, Kindergarten Cop, probably one of her biggest roles in 1990, Other People's Money in 91, You're the Comet in 92, and Carlito's Way in 93, for which she received a Golden Globe Award nomination. Other films include a starring role in The Relic in 97, supporting roles in Chaplin in 92, Along Came a Spider in 2001, and The Artist in 2011. And of course, really she was on the cool. TV show. Yeah, she was on the TV show Weeds on Showtime for a good while as well. So
I'm going to have to look that up. I watched that show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's her. Same person.
Interesting. And
isn't she the same one in Red with Bruce Willis? No. I'm thinking of somebody
Mary
else.
Mary Louise Parker.
Okay, maybe I'm getting the two of them confused. Mary Louise Parker yep. was the one on Weeds. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm getting them
I was
mixed
like,
up.
Whoa.
Yeah, I got those mixed up. I'm like, okay. I was like, why didn't that show up in my facts? Because that's not true. I got them mixed up.
Because it was not her.
Right.
I'm sure she would love to get some money residuals from Weeds.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. All the stuff that happens to her in the
she
bus
deserves
station.
It. I'm sorry.
I was like, that could have been its own separate movie. Like, Adventures in the Bus Station could have been its own my favorite one, though. Well, my two favorite, I don't know, they're all favorites. I love the old guy. You're in my house.
You just moved.
Yeah. I love that. And then when the lady takes her glasses and leaves the sunglasses while she's watching the Brady Bunch. It's hilarious. And then
it's really good. The rat.
Yeah, the rat. Oh gosh. That was funny. And then of course my favorite one is
the hot dog.
If you don't have any money, I don't have a wiener, which I'm going to talk about that when we get into trivia as well. Cause that was an added scene later.
Really? So,
yeah. Yeah. Was it? She's like, there's a guy with a gun. Like, why is a guy standing there opening his coat with a gun?
Like so crazy. It is so funny. Like, it's not fair to say that she deserves it, but at the same time, like they don't go into details. And so the fact that she's just 17, she's like, I hate my stepmom. Why? Why do you hate her? What did she do?
Right.
No, I need details. What is so bad that you ran away from home? And so it's just, it makes you wonder, like, okay, what led to this? I need a Brenda story, I guess, because she's just crazy.
I love that when they get back home, like at the end, and she's standing at the door, it's like, okay, Brenda, go home. I can't go home. You got to go. And she just pushed out the door and closes the door. And like, that's it. Like, Brenda's gone at that point. Like,
Brenda.
Yeah, it's like, you've been enough of a problem. Go home. I can't deal with it anymore. Oh, gosh. So funny. All right. We got a few more here. Bradley Whitford as Mike Todwell. So cool. Whitford first appeared on television in a 1985 episode of The Equalizer, followed by a two-year recurring role on the ABC daytime drama All My Children. He does seem like a soap opera actor. I'm not just kidding. His film debut was in the 1986 film Dead as a Doorman. He made his Broadway theater debut in 1990, playing Lieutenant Jack Ross, followed a few months later in the lead role of Lieutenant Daniel Caffey in the Aaron Sorkin written play A Few Good Men. I love that movie. This was the beginning of a recurring working relationship between Whitford and Sorkin. Of course, he joined the cast of The West Wing as Josh Lyman with the show's premiere in 1999. For his role, he won an Emmy Award in 2001 for Best Supporting Actor in a Drama Series. My favorite fact is he was allowed to use his own Camaro for the movie, and the license plate, so cool, was the actual license plate he had on his car.
He is... Like, if you looked up in the dictionary the word smarmy, his picture would be next to it. And you would just, there would be no definition. It would just be his picture. You'd be like, oh, okay, I know exactly what smarmy means now.
And when he comes to the door, I mean, surely he's in college. I mean, there's no way he's in high school.
He can run for president. He's so.
he tries to act young, but he looks like you can see the 5 o'clock shadow piercing through his makeup to not make him look younger. So
yeah, HD did not do him any favors when it came to this movie. I love that actor because he does such a great job of playing the bad guy. He's always the bad guy.
Yeah,
and I in my brain. Because he's currently, or he was, on a few seasons of The Handmaid's Tale. And I like to, in my brain, imagine that this movie happens in the same universe. Because he's one of the, like, founding people of the society in The Handmaid's Tale. And so I'd like to think that he grows up one day to become the ultimate bad guy.
Interesting theory. Okay. I'm with you. I'm with you. It makes sense. I mean, hey, Laramie can believe that, you know, Officer Powell was from Family Matters and, you know, he left LA and moved to Chicago and all that kind of stuff. So.
Maybe Laramie and I just like to live in a world where actors.
Everybody's connected.
Everything's connected.
Right.
And actors, like, their IMDb page is telling one story.
Mm-hmm. You know, when certain actors play the same type of role over and over again, it's easy for that to seem a correlation there. But
I love Bradley Whitford because he does such a good job of playing just an absolute a-hole. in everything right. he does.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he just, his face, it's just his face. You just want it. He's got a punchable face.
I was just about to ask you that question. I was like, would you say his face is punchable?
It sure is. Like, the second she opens the door and she spent all of that time mm-hmm. getting ready and she looks so cute. Mm-hmm. He opens the door and he's in his stupid jeans and tennis right. shoes and he's just standing there like.
Yeah, I'm sorry. My sister's sick.
My sister's sick. I'm contagious. Shut right. up. No, you're not. It was the one time in the movie where Brenda was right. He's lying. Mm-hmm. And yeah. she could do better than him. I also right. love that like mm. overarching thing throughout the movie of everyone telling her, like, you can do so much better mm-hmm. than him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you are better than him. He right. is not worth it. And she's like, no, he's the best thing that's ever happened to me. He's the only thing that's ever happened yeah, to
that
you.
That was a great line.
Move on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's such a 17-year-old thing way to be.
Yeah, which is why I thought he was in college. Like, she's like, oh, well, yeah. he's, you know, obviously he's older, because I'm assuming that if she's 17, she'll be a junior.
Supposed no, to be. I thought she was supposed to be a senior.
Yeah, she does say that in the party. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't see them being the same age. Like, he's definitely a freshman in college,
if not a junior or a sophomore.
Sophomore. Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe they've been dating for a while. He's already graduated. Kind of a thing, so
ugh. Just bleh. So cool. Red flag after red flag with that right. one.
Right. I want to think that's real. That is the so cool license plate was yeah. his. But how convenient that's what they see outside the restaurant, that his car is parked there yeah. with the license plate. So that's a little, you know. Once again, everything is such a unique coincidence, or like a perfectly yeah. timed coincidence. I want to mention Calvin Levels as Joe Gipp. He was great in this.
Yes.
An actor that did not really do much after this, and I don't know why, because I thought he was great in his character.
So good.
Yeah. So I definitely wanted to mention his name, even though we don't have any, you know, other things he's been in. And then we mentioned earlier George Newbern, which is not the name I associate with his face, as Dan Lynch, the college student.
Yeah.
He just doesn't look like a George Newbern. That just...
No.
I want to see him as like a 50-year-old man sitting in an Oxford yeah. sweater with his legs crossed in front of a fireplace. But anyway.
He's best friends with Bob Newhart, George yeah. Newbern.
Yeah. But his first lead role was in the 1987 Double Switch. We talked about that one already. From 86 to 92, he had a recurring role as Payne McElroy, the son of designer Julia Sugarbaker, played by Dixie Carter on the series Designing Women, which what a great show that was.
I love that show. Yep.
He has since guest starred on television programs such as Providence, Chicago Hope, Friends, Bull, CSI, Medium, Ghost Whisperer, Touched by an Angel, Criminal Minds, and Private Practice. Of course, most people remember him as the former CIA operative on Scandal a couple of years ago. And of course, his film credits include Switching Channels from 1988 with Kathleen Turner, Burt Reynolds, and Christopher Reeve, and Father of the Bride and its sequel, Father of the Bride Part 2, which is probably the one that I remember him the most from. I was a big yeah. Father of the Bride fan with Steve Martin.
Yeah. If Bradley Whitford has a punchable face,
mm-hmm.
George Newbern has the exact opposite, which I guess would be a kissable face. Like, he's just like a precious.
Mm-hmm.
He's just
mm-hmm.
precious.
Yeah.
And yeah, he was perfect for that role. Like, you just needed to cast somebody who you instantly was just like, she's mm-hmm. gonna like him,
right?
And
right.
she's gonna want to kiss him later.
Yeah, yeah. I like how like she's at the party and they lock eyes, or she looks at him a couple of times like, wait, don't you have a boyfriend that's supposed to be home taking care of a sick yeah. daughter? And all of a sudden now you're like
she has not broken up with this right. guy yet.
Google eyes with the guy at the college party. So, and once again, perfect coincidence. There's this college oh, yeah. party with a bunch of kids and don't get thrown out, that no one's throwing up on them, that they're, you know, and they meet this guy that's going to give her $50 to a girl that he's never met before.
Never met, never seen, doesn't know. But you know what? It's fate.
Right.
They love
right.
each other. It's
yeah.
Love at this first sight. The best thing that's ever happened to her,
right,
too.
Right. Right. He's no longer the only thing that happened to her. Now she has a yeah. second thing that's happening to her.
Now she's had two whole things happen to her.
All right, I got to get through this cast.
Sorry.
All right, so I'm just going to mention the next couple of just great characters. This was all like the, you know, kind of side characters. John Chandler played Bleak, the mob boss, which he was great. Anakin trying to imitate his voice watching the movie, which is like, I can't do it. But he was great. My favorite part is him with the parents, and they're like, do you know who made these quiches? What? The caterer? What?
When we were watching that scene, Laramie was in the room, and Laramie goes like, is he a robot? Like, why? what is his problem?
And then the parents, if you believe, it's like, you haven't seen this guy at all at the party for the last 4 hours you've been there. He's standing behind the table. He doesn't look like he belongs there at all, but you were to have them asking these questions. And then I love how when she causes him to trip over the cord and he falls, they're taking, like, be careful, like he passed out, like, you know, don't, they're being very careful with him on the floor, which I thought was great.
So good.
So he's the only person in the movie that gets knocked out twice, because he gets knocked over then, and then of course Joe Gibb punches him out, you know.
So
and I do like that every time Joe Gibb is on screen, someone calls him Joe Gibb. So obviously there's another Joe in the organization, because they don't just call him Joe. He is Joe Gibb.
It's like in school, there was the Kaylee W, Kaylee R, and Kaylee S.
Right, right.
I love the idea that there are two Joes.
Yeah.
So we've got a Joe Gibb, we've got a Joe John, we've got a Joe Jan Jackson.
Right. And then Joe Johnson.
Joe Johnson, excuse me.
All right, so then we got Ron Canada as Graydon, the Bleak's second in command, which I know he's been in some other stuff. The heavier set black guy, he was good.
Yeah.
John Ford Noonan as handsome John Pruitt, another one of my favorite characters. John Pruitt was great. I love when he comes out there and he's like, he's whistling and got his hands behind his back, you know.
So wild. That character is crazy. I know we're trying to power through this.
No,
but
go ahead.
I love, he shows up. He establishes himself as like a good, trustworthy guy.
Right.
Like, he's super nice to these kids. And you're just like, okay, well, how is it? Oh, his wife's cheating on him. And he completely blacks out.
Right. Right.
Doesn't realize that he's got four kids in the car next to him.
That's what happens when you go in the city. Stay in the suburbs, kids.
But at least, no, you know what? No, he still should have paid for their tire.
Yeah.
He told him he was going to pay for their tire, and then he shot their car up.
Right, right. But I do love how he's playing with the kids in the cab, like before he gets the call about, you know, how'd you lose your hand? Yeah, he's like, well, I still have it. You do? Where is it? It's in the glove compartment. And then I love with Daryl when he grabs the gun. He's got his hands covered. He's like, is it a hand? No. Oh, thank God. It's a gun. Oh, God.
And God.
great writing, great execution,
great performance.
Those little things make it so rewatchable, because they're such fun moments,
and it still like holds up in that sense, because adults mess with kids like that. It doesn't matter, like I'm always messing with my kids.
And
they know me well enough to know that they can just be like, mama.
Right.
Whereas, you know, he's a complete stranger and he's like, oh yeah, I lost my hand. It's in the glove compartment.
Right. Which is, once again, makes him even more endearing, even though
He
goes crazy. You still
he
like
loses
him. Like, he's still
his mind. Right.
He's still a great character. Like, he's still, I would still like call, like if my car broke down, I'd still call him. Like, hey, can we just not go by your house this time? But can you come help me?
I'm going to need you to make sure before you pick me up that Beverly does not have that car outside of your house.
Right. And then I love they have an actual fist fight with him and the adulterer or whatever. And the guy,
like the most ridiculous fist fight in the middle of the road.
Right. It's highly choreographed, but just a few punches. But, you know, he can't hit him with the hook. So all the punches are with this good hand, which I love.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Oh, we can talk about this movie for 4 hours. Okay, moving on.
We don't need to.
The other big name of the movie, that before anybody knew he was a big name, Vincent D'Onofrio as Dawson, or Thor in disguise, as we know at the end. His first paid role was in Off-Broadway's This Property is Condemned. He continued appearing in plays and worked as a bouncer, a bodyguard, and a delivery man. As a film actor, his career break came when he played a mentally unbalanced recruit in Full Metal Jacket, also in 1987, directed by Stanley Kubrick. for his role, D'Onofrio gained nearly 70 pounds. He had a major role in Dying Young in 91 and appeared prominently in the box office smash Men in Black in 1997 as the bad guy Edgar the Bug. Other films of note are Mystic Pizza in 88, JFK in 91, The Player in 92, Ed Wood in 94, The Cell in 2000, The Breakup in 2006, and Jurassic World in 2015. But he's been in
everything.
Yeah. But I did read that. So he went to film this right after finishing Full Metal Jacket, and he like lost all that weight and got in shape for the role of Dawson very quickly. So, I mean, he looked great when he comes out.
Yeah,
at the end,
he looks like Thor.
Yeah, exactly. Which I can even say, like, even as a kid, I wouldn't say that I was a big, you know, of course your husband is a big comic person. I wasn't
but I didn't know comics. Him then.
Yeah. But yeah, true. But I kind of knew who Thor was. But of course, the good thing about what I loved about Sarah's bedroom is she had all those pictures of Thor.
Yeah.
Like the huge, like big cutouts against the wall. Like even if you didn't know who Thor was, they gave you those establishing pictures so that when he came at the end, it's like, oh my gosh, he looks just like Thor. So
yeah,
that was cool how they were able to do that.
But no, it was, this movie was probably my first introduction to Thor because my parents were not comic book people. We didn't watch a ton of superhero things when I was a kid. And so this movie was just my introduction to Thor and those visual images up in her bedroom at the beginning and her pictures and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's perfect.
And I love how she was using Brad's Clearasil because she ran out of brown.
So good.
That was hilarious. Yeah. Last person, Lolita Davidovich, I guess you say that. So she was a big actress more so in the 90s, but she was the one that was, they have her listed on IMDb as Luann, but in the credits, she's just the drunk girl, which is the girl at the party that's making out with Daryl. But she's best known for portraying Blaze Starr in the 1989 film Blaze, for which she received a Chicago Film Critics Association Award nomination. She later had starring roles in films including Leap of Faith in 92, Raising Kane in 92, Intersection in 94, Cobb in 94, Jungle to Jungle in 97, Gods and Monsters in 98, Mystery Alaska in 99, and Play It to the Bone in 99. So I recognize her face. Like, she's definitely much younger there, playing a college student. But
I love her in Jungle to Jungle.
Yeah.
Oh, Jungle to Jungle's great.
Tim Allen.
Oh, yeah.
Disney.
And now, these messages.
What's up, dudes? I'm Jerry D of Totally Rad Christmas, the podcast that talks all things Christmas in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, books, fashion, and fads.
If it was gnarly during Christmas in the 80s, he's got it covered. Wait, is there a lot of things to talk about for the 80s and Christmas?
Well, you got the movie giants like Christmas Vacation, Scrooged, and A Christmas Story. There are TV specials like Muppet Family Christmas, Claymation Christmas Celebration, and A Garfield Christmas Special.
Plus classics shown every year.
You also jam out to Last Christmas, Do They Know It's Christmas, and Christmas in Hollis. But most of all, it was a time for the most bodacious, best-selling Christmas toys ever, like He-Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers,
and Cabbage Patch Kids.
Yes, them too. We cover them all, plus much more, including standard segments like Hap Hap Happiest Memory, Gag Me with the Spoon, The Other Half of the Battle,
and Chant with the Littles.
So tune in to Totally Rad Christmas everywhere you get your podcasts. Turn the clock back and dive into those warm and fuzzy memories.
Later, dudes.
Let's talk about iconic favorite scenes. What is your iconic scene?
So I have two.
Okay.
But the most iconic to me is that opening scene
of
her dancing to And Then He Kissed Me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it is, for me, it was a very relatable scene, just like the dancing around your room, and also establishes later her kind of being like a secret performer, which is why she's able to sing the blues later.
Right.
But also it establishes she's young. She's clearly very young.
Mm-hmm.
She's got this cute, but I mean, who hasn't like done the like curtain over their head and pretended it was a veil and walked through, like, oh, every second of that scene. I probably, just for this viewing alone, watched that scene 5 times. I love it. It's just, it's so precious. It it just gets you excited about the movie you're about to watch. But my second scene is the scene of them singing the blues.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my number one.
It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah. Babysitting Blues is when I think of this movie, that's the first scene I think of. And there's other great scenes. Other favorite scenes is the subway with the gangs. It's hilarious.
Babysitter.
Yeah. one of the few PG-13 movies that allowed the F word to be in it twice. But yeah, so that scene, ones we've already talked about, meeting Pruitt for the first time.
Yes.
I love the scene at the hospital where the doctor is like, I'm sorry, your friend is dead.
He's dead.
Yeah.
And she passes out, and then there he is. So good. I love that. I love the scene where she's out on the window ledge. That's such a stressful scene.
Right.
It just her Elizabeth Shue walking around the party in the big fluffy coat.
Right.
Just trying to be really subtle. It's all of it. It's a nonstop iconic scene movie.
There's fantastic. So many, and like I said, all just about every scene with the friend Brenda at the bus station, like every single scene, she almost steals the movie from Elizabeth Shue.
Yeah.
If they had done more in the bus stop, she almost would have stole the movie from her. But like I said, it could have been its own separate movie.
Yes.
Honestly. I mean, if we never saw what Brenda went through,
it would still be a great movie. It would still
be a great movie because there's enough going on, but it's just the added little bits were good because there were kind of comic relief when all the
running around. It was a tension breaking machine, but also it established why it's important
that they get to
that
her.
Chris gets to her.
Yeah.
Because she could die.
Yeah. Right. Life without cell phones is so funny.
But also, at what point do you have to let go of your grudge with your stepmom? Like, at what point could she have just called her dad and said, Dad, I'm at the bus stop. You need to come get me now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But then there'd be no movie. Wouldn't that be terrible? If she got there and she's like, where are you? She's like, oh, I'm home now. Sorry.
I called
my daddy, picked me up. Yeah.
I figured you gave up.
Right.
I was here for 2 hours waiting for you.
It's kind of good that they didn't lean too much into the bad guys. Like they're there to chase them and that's about it. But there wasn't anything super, sinister about them. Like we didn't think they were really going to kill them. They really just wanted the magazine back. That was the main thing. Yeah. They needed that for the job, which once again, they didn't have to go into great depth of what kind of operation they're running. You just knew they were the bad guys.
It's a chop shop. They ran a chop shop and honestly, it's not a victimless crime, but it's not a violent crime spree they're running. So you're not concerned about them hurting people. Yes. Probably putting financial burdens on people, but at the end of the day, their insurance will help them.
Right. Let's talk about some trivia, other scenes, some trivia. I may have to skip some of these and put them in the show notes, but we talked about Sarah's obsession with Thor. Yes. That was not the original obsession she had.
What was the original obsession?
The first one was Dan Rather.
That would have been an interesting, not at all. Can you imagine the posters on her wall?
Right.
And how she would dress.
Right. So so it went through a few phases. This is according to Simpkins, the screenwriter. He said originally she had a crush on Dan Rather. In the original script, she was actually a news junkie. Then we changed it to her having a crush on the Chicago Bears. But Jeffrey Katzenberg from Disney said no, because in 10 minutes, nobody's going to remember them. So that if you would have had them as camp, because I think there was a scene that was written where they were going to go to the Bears stadium and run into some of the players for cameos, but then that dates the movie too much. I mean, I think that was a smart choice. So then they started landing on comic book characters because Chris Columbus was a big comic book person. He said, we tried really hard to get Spider-Man. That was our big push, but Marvel kept saying no. Finally, they came to us and said, we've got this Thor guy. Just take him and use him. Do whatever you want. So they got to just you know, which I think is perfect.
It's really perfect.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
it's such, and especially it has helped the movie age a little better because mm-hmm. now everyone does oh, yeah. know who Thor is.
Yeah, of course.
Whereas at the time, it just kind of introduced people to mm-hmm. Thor.
Right.
And it helps that, you know, it doesn't age the movie because Thor has been around a long time.
Right. He's right. Being still a comic around. Book character. Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't age, you know, and that yes. kind of thing. So he has a
and
different
because he wasn't actually Thor. Mm-hmm. It's just this childhood wonder mm-hmm. that wins over.
Yeah.
What was his name again?
Dawson.
Dawson.
Yeah. Dawson's Garage, which I thought was cool that if you notice, and I think I only noticed it this time, on Pruitt's truck, when you see Dawson's yeah. Garage, the Dawson's is drawn almost like comic book character block letters.
Oh,
like it's
cool.
almost comic bookish the way it's written. I was like, oh, that was really smart for the yeah. set designer to do that, to kind of foreshadow Hint. And allude yeah. to it in the later. So,
yeah.
All right, so we talked about the hot dog scene with Brenda at the bus station. That was a last-minute addition. So Keith Coogan said they had shot out the bus station on the Chop Shot set. They built an insert. So basically, those are all studio, the Chop mm-hmm. Shop and the bus station. They built an insert set just for the hot dog scene. Simpkins continued, Disney was asking for something, more time or whatever. Chris and I thought it was ridiculous, so I wrote this scene we'd never use, which was the slip me the wiener line. And they used it, and I was mortified. So
good.
Yeah. So I guess they were looking for.
You've like got you said, no money. I've got no wiener.
Yeah. It's like it's a perfect good check. You know, like I bought makeup from Chris, and she wrote the book. I'm writing it over to you.
To his credit, like it's not. It's like a twice endorsed check.
Right. Right. Which dates this. Significantly,
so much. Yeah,
because like even back then, I was like, you can double, you know, you can double check, you know, you can double sign a check. I mean, I think my mom had done that once or twice, like as you know, once I got a little yeah. older, or I remember that being something that was done where people would give you a check and you sign it over to somebody else or whatever.
Yeah,
but
I don't understand how that would happen. Like, I don't yeah. just Venmo me. It's yeah. fine,
right? But I love you. She's like, you're gonna throw the hot dog away? It's still money.
It's a perfectly like, good check. You would rather throw the hot dog away than give it to me.
It's a great scene. But yeah, I think like you said, they were trying to find those lighter scenes to kind of lighten up some of the, you know, more stressful aspects. So that was funny that they that was like a throwaway scene, like they'll never make the movie, and they put it in. And we're still talking sure about enough. It now. All right, let's talk about the blues. So director Chris Columbus wanted to make the movie set in Chicago to capture the city's blues scene, which the soundtrack is very blues heavy. Yeah.
Oh, it's such a good soundtrack.
Yeah. So Simpkins said when Chris came on board, many of his many contributions was telling me he wanted the movie set in Chicago for the Chicago blues scene. None of that music was in the script. That was all Chris's contribution. He said the iconic blues bar scene wasn't in the original draft. He said, Chris said to me early on, as these kids are running around escaping from the bad guys, I want them to run into a blues bar and stop to sing a song. I was like, are you nuts? There is no way to do that. He said, figure it out. He said, weeks go by and he knocks on my door and he says, how's that scene going? I said, it's not. Chris, I really don't want to do it. I don't understand the scene. I don't know how it happens, why they're being forced to sing on stage. Chris looked at me and said, it's a house rule. They don't leave the stage until they sing the blues. He said, I wish I could take credit for that, but that was all Chris Columbus.
I'm so glad.
Yeah.
It's such a good scene. Like, that, this movie is borderline a musical because
yes.
of this scene and the very
yes.
first one.
Yeah.
And which is probably why I adore it so much. And that mm-hmm. scene is so good. That song is so catchy.
Right. But it's also, that's one of the most iconic lines. Like, that is probably the iconic line from the movie is nobody leave this place without singing the blues. I mean, like
if somebody
shouted that out in a crowd, you would
know
that's
from
Adventures of Babysitting. You know, it's like that's iconic. It's an iconic line. So bravo to Chris Columbus for doing that. All right.
These guys.
Sorry. Yeah. But and there was a soundtrack for this movie, which of course you can get now on iTunes. But I remember when this movie came out, I searched and there was no Amazon. It was, you could only yeah. go to record stores or, you know, try to find, you know, Sam Goody's, Turtles.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I could never find the soundtrack. So I literally had a tape recorder that I had recorded the song off the TV so that I could go back and listen to it because I love that. I did the same thing with Howard the Duck for, you know, but, you know, like, which could be, it's, you know, if I did one shots like Laramie, I would do a one shot about who did it, who sang better on film, Leah Thompson or Elizabeth Shue, because they both had their singing, you know, their singing debuts in the movies.
Elizabeth Shue. I'm just gonna say, sorry.
It's tough.
It's so hard babysitting these guys.
Yeah. Anyway, all right. So moving on. So, where is the? Let's see. Oh, so Keith Coogan talked about how they did the scene. So he said, we went on a Sunday to record in a recording studio in Chicago with Albert Collins and the Icebreakers, the band. There was some structure for the song, but they basically in one or two takes pounded out the music for it and Albert's part. Then they brought us in and Lisa did her part with Albert and we did our backups. He said the next day we were at the blues bar with that as a playback and we were lip syncing to it. He said, but Albert Collins had never lip synced in his life. So there was a learning curve. So it took him a lot longer to film that scene than they wanted to, because he wasn't used to lip syncing, which I thought was great. Great scene.
So good.
Speaking of Brad, this might be the last little. No, I'll have one after this. So in the film, of course, Chris breaks the heart of young Brad when she doesn't reciprocate his romantic feelings towards her. But of course, life imitates art, as Keith Coogan actually was quite keen on Elizabeth Shue, despite the fact that she was 6 years older than him. She was 23 and he was turning 17 during filming. He recalls taking Shue to what she thought was a strictly work-related restaurant dinner, only for him to suggest that they date. Coogan stated that she laughed in his face exactly like the laugh she does in the movie. He said, she totally crushed my heart and I took that with me for the film. And I will say, after reading that, it's very evident. Like, you can see it. Him,
he adores her.
Yeah. Like I told Keith in the interview, I was like, you know, he became such a good favorite actor from this movie because I was him. Like, he was the character that represented me. And I had a best friend just like Daryl that was trying to get me in trouble. No. And, you know, so it was like that dynamic was like, I saw myself on screen in that movie. So, and of course there was a babysitter. I didn't have a babysitter that I really, at that age, that I pined for, but I remember being a little kid and like teenage babysitters was like, oh, she's cute or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, who knows what I thought back then. But anyway.
Ooh, I like her. I don't understand why I like her so much, but I do like her.
I thought this was interesting. An accidental issue with one of the props led to the end, how the movie ended, how it kind of came together. So So Simpkins in his interview said, we were shooting the sequence behind the toy store, running down the alley with that really clumsy line of dialogue. It was late and we were stuck and we needed to get it out. So Sarah had the hat, the hammer, the backpack, the cape. The girls loaded up. We're done for the night. Everything was all gone. Everyone was all gone. And our script supervisor, Sue Richards, comes up to me and says, I feel so terrible. She didn't have the backpack in that scene. She should have had it and she didn't have it. He said, Chris and I were thinking this is a big deal. And we thought, wait, we can fix this. We never really thought of how George, the boyfriend, shows up at the house unless the skate was in the car with the address on it. So forgetting the backpack is how the skate ended up in the car and how he ended up at the house. It was a fortunate accident.
That's really cute.
I was like, that was pretty cool.
I like that.
And then my last little bit of trivia. In the film, Chris Parker is a 17-year-old high school student and 4 years younger than Dan Lynch, who is a 21-year-old college student. When the film was released, Elizabeth Shue was 23 years old and 1 year older than George Newbern, who was 22 years old.
You can't tell.
No, I think they honestly look about the same age, which is why again, it's hard for them to think that she was still in high school. But
did you see the trivia about the magazine?
Yes, I did. You want to talk about it?
I don't mind if you don't mind.
Go ahead. Yeah, it was when I skipped, but you go ahead.
It's actually Elizabeth Shue posed. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So she's fully clothed, but she did pose at the Playboy Mansion, mm-hmm. and she still has the magazine to this day.
And I would think she probably does, because she was very adamant about people knowing that she was fully clothed, that there was no. So I'm sure that's why she has the magazine, because she doesn't want people ogling over
her. Yeah. You know,
pictures that are somewhat risque anyway. So,
yeah. I mean, as risque as. I mean, it really is just like a feather. You can't really see a ton
no
in the movie, but it's so It's such a weird through line.
It is a weird throughout the movie. It is weird. Yeah. I read somewhere that it originally was R, but then they tried to trim it back to give it a wider release. But I'm like, I can't imagine this ever being an R-rated movie. But they're still like that being a through line was still a little bit more adult than what you would expect from more of a family comedy.
And but everything Daryl says.
Yeah. But it was PG-13. So, you know, and this is a couple of years after, you know, 2 years after PG-13 became a rating. So the studios were they were playing with that line of like trying to find the balance of what, you know, how much of adult can we put in this kid movie and kind of appeal to the parents that are coming with the kids and the teenagers are going to go see it because of Elizabeth Shue as well. So, yeah, it makes sense. All right. Any other trivia or scenes you want to mention before we talk about box office and critical reception?
Not that I can think of, no.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about it. Adventures in Babysitting debuted in North American theaters on July 3rd, 1987. I had no idea this was a July 4th movie.
Good for it.
Yeah. It debuted at number 9, being beat out by the other new release of the week, Innerspace, which debuted at number 3. It eventually moved up to number 5 in the second week, but fell back to number 7 the following week. It remained in the top 10 all 4 weeks of July and ultimately brought up over $34 million on an estimated $7 million budget, making it a financial success. So it did.
Absolutely.
Did well.
Yeah.
So Rotten Tomatoes has it at 71% on the tomato meter with a 70% audience score. IMDb is pretty close, 6.9 out of 10 with viewers, but a 45 on Metacritic, which we all know Metacritic never gets it right. So
no.
But where does this rank for you? Is it in the 70s, 80s, 90s?
I would say it's a solid 9.9 out of 10.
Oh, okay.
It's not a perfect movie. Nostalgia heavily weighs it.
Right.
But it's a fun, it's a romp. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You don't sit down, you don't have to think too hard about it. You don't even have to pay too much attention to it. And you're still gonna be able to know exactly what's going on. Mm-hmm. It's fun and you need those movies. And I think we should rate those kinds of movies just as high as we do like psychological movies that win Oscars and things that.
Of course.
I would much rather sit and watch an Adventures in Babysitting than I would like a Lincoln.
Right.
So in my opinion, it's a solid 9. It's funny. It's lighthearted. It's interesting and it's great.
Yep. It's well established on the show that I rate based on rewatchability and because this is highly rewatchable and easily in my top 10 movies of the 80s, one that I would pop in and watch at any time. If it came on TV anymore, like it did back in the day, if it was on, I'd stop and watch it, you know, even with the commercials. So it is flawed in some areas. Like I said, the TV version might be a little bit more acceptable today with some of the language. So that's why it loses a couple of dings for me in the original theatrical because it's a little problematic in some spots. I'm maybe like high 80s, low 90s, but still very much one of my favorites and very rewatchable.
Absolutely. I agree. It's just a good movie. If you haven't seen it, just go watch it.
Yeah.
Great.
I don't know.
It's on Disney Plus.
Right. I don't know why you listen to this whole podcast and have never seen it before, but
you're just a really big fan of this podcast.
Of course. And we appreciate it. Always be a fan. I have one final question for you before we wrap it all up.
Okay, let's do it.
Was there an American treasure in this movie?
So I don't know if I said this during Back to the Future, but Elizabeth Shue, 100%, hands down, no question asked. This movie, she is just a delight. She's precious. She established herself as the American sweetheart in this movie. Mm-hmm. She is a treasure.
Yeah.
Oh, every single thing in this movie is just so good. Yeah. Love her.
She plays the role perfectly. Even watching it again today, there are certain things I picked up on just watching her reactions and how, you know, emotion that you could see just through facial expressions. She nailed this easily. And once again, I think And Keith, once again, mentioned the interview, go back and listen to it, but he talked about they had as much fun filming this as we have watching it, which you always tell. Which always comes across really well. Like for you can tell when they're having a good time. So so that's one of those rarities too, which makes it one of those movies you want to cherish.
It wasn't one of those movies where like teens grow up and they're traumatized because of the experience they had with the movie.
Right. Love it. Thank you so much for being a part of this episode. Bethany, it's always good to have you on the show.
Thanks, Tim.
Gotta have you on more often. We gotta work you back in the rotation.
I'm here for it whenever you need me.
Appreciate it. So be sure to follow, subscribe, rate, review the podcast. If you haven't heard, we have a new email address. It's info@80sflickflashback.com. Please send us a nice little email and tell us what you think about the show and just say hello. Let us know you're listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with someone who loves 80s flicks or Elizabeth Shue or Keith Coogan or Chris Columbus.
Or maybe, definitely send it to Elizabeth Shue and tell her we could be friends. I would be totally cool. I'm not cool.
Yes, she can be on the show anytime. Absolutely.
Sit there, but I promise not to say a single word. I will just sit there quietly and listen to anything she has to say.
Yeah, I would struggle to get words to come out of my mouth. Follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Please support the show. You can do it through buymeacoffee.com. You can also buy a t-shirt or sweatshirt from the website. You can find us on tpublic.com. We have some new designs that came out for fall and Halloween, but I'm working on some Christmas ones, so look for those in the next couple weeks. So hope everybody has an awesome November. Got another great episode coming up in a few weeks, but thanks again, Bethany, for joining. Thanks everybody for listening. I'm Tim Williams for the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. Good night, good people.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.